I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. My name is Don.
Hi, Don.
Oh, this must be what it feels like to be high on drugs. Because it feels really different, you know. I understand you have some people here that cry from the podium. Amateurs. Don't worry, I will use that. The only thing, how long will it take me? There we go. I guess I should qualify for the program. When I went to my first meeting of Al-Anon, I called central office in Dallas, Texas. Oh, my name is, I did say my name, didn't I? I did that, yeah. Oh, that's the drugs. or whatever is doing this to me. But I called and I asked if they had a gay group. And she went, what? I went, damn. Gay group. Oh, you must mean Lambda. So, yeah, she did. And so I found out where it was and when and everything. They didn't tell me the dress code. God. So I didn't know what I was supposed to wear. I mean, you know, do you wear a suit? Do you wear casual? I decided business casual, okay? A tie with a sweater vest. You can always take them off. When I came here Friday. Thank you to the committee, by the way, and Stephen picked me up there. Akita, thank you so much for we've been communicating for a while, and I want to thank the committee. It's been a great roundup. Wonderful roundup. I'm so happy. I had such a wonderful day yesterday. I needed it so bad. Here we go. I needed it so bad. I'll get to the real stuff in a minute. But I came in. I was like, what? Oh, here you go. Kindred spirits, okay. So I came in Friday night and I said, now, I brought, of course, two different outfits to wear this morning. I said, do they, because, you know, we have a group in Dallas, so you have to wear a tie from the podium, and women who speak have to wear a dress. A dress. Not a pants suit. So I wasn't sure, so I watched this. So I watched last night, and there was Joao in his jeans and hoodie. I went, thank God, jeans and a hoodie, wonderful. Then Vera gets up in this suit. Went, oh, crap. That's not going to help at all. Now the vote is now split. So I came around Saturday morning and noticed that she wasn't speaking, and Vera still had on a suit. So I just negated her vote. I didn't even tell her. And so then luckily, thank goodness, that Scott did not wear a tie last night. Actually, I'll tell you the truth, and that is that I decided to wear what I wanted to before I saw Scott last night. But that was a big step. That was a big step for me, let me tell you. You know, I don't know. I like rules. I really do. And I like correcting rules when they're wrong. And I don't know if you, I've not seen it here in Canada. I don't know if you have it, but there's this new thing they do in the U.S., and maybe it's just the South, I don't know. And they give you a little rules in the bathroom about how to wash your hands. They're wrong. See, they worry about what you touch and where your hands are clean. They don't realize I'm going to wash my hands and then clean every single surface for the next person. They don't realize that I'm like washing. The rules don't apply to me at all. I allow myself 3 paper towels to wipe up on the sink, and that's it. Because more than that is a compulsion. I wish I were making this up. I really do. You all had some wonderful workshops. I really enjoy them. I came also, I wanted to have the perfect roundup, so I picked all the workshops I was going to go to. Then I got up Saturday morning and said, to heck with this. I had this other little problem, and that is I didn't pack completely. Of course, I packed 2 days before I left. You know, people make fun of me for that, too. But I had apparently, there's a certain item of clothing still sitting on my bed next to where my suitcase was. So I wasn't fully prepared. So Saturday morning, I realized I was powerless over my packing and turned my will and my life over Eaton Center shopping mall and walked down their commando to buy something that I needed. I just learned that term in May. I didn't know what that term meant before. So I decided I'm just going to go to whatever workshop I want to. I had a wonderful time in the Step 2 workshop. Everyone should go to the Step 2 workshop every time they're here. You know, I look at the steps and I love all the steps, but my favorite one is Step 2, because Step 2 tells me I'm going to be okay. And trust me, that hasn't always been the case in my brain and in my heart. I can look at Step 2 and I can be okay. That was a wonderful workshop to hear people. You know, when I picked my first sponsor, I purposely picked an atheist. That if he can have a higher power, I want to hear about it. You know, because I was raised with real lots of religion, you know, and I still have a share of that. But I wanted to hear how that person did it. And I love hearing different stories about higher power. I went to the, I made a God box in the God box workshop. And I love that because I got to help clean up afterwards. Now, I stopped before it was done. That was a big step. Okay, enough of that. Like I said, I was raised in a real religious home, and life was church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, Royal Ambassadors on Thursday night, in case you want to figure out what religion it was. And it was a big deal to me, and I was a very precocious child, and they had no real restrictions about what age one became saved, was the term they used, had that conversion. Now, my parents didn't talk about it much, but pardon me for my voice. It's much better than it was Thursday. I'm getting over a cold. But if it goes out like a radio, just let me know. But I went to church all the time and listened to what they were saying. And I didn't hear too many bad messages back then, you know, that people kind of feel abused by religion. But I just listened, and I was just a child. And I had a childlike faith. And at the age of 5, the tender age of 5, I went to my mother and said, I think I'm ready to be saved. I said it just like that. My mother kind of freaked out because we didn't talk about that much at home. So she made an appointment with the preacher for me, the pastor of our church. And I went to see him and I sat there in the chair. My feet didn't even hit the floor and we were talking about being saved. And he just asked me some very simple questions. And faith is very simple. Faith is not complicated. It's not easy, necessarily, but it's very simple. And he asked me some simple questions, and he said, you know, Don, I believe you really are. I believe you're ready, you know. And so they had to put a special stool in the immersion thing for the baptism, because we go all the way under in that church, you know. And and, you know, I did the whole thing. At the age of 5, I was a voting member of the church. It's so scary. To show you how really precocious I watched all these people in church rededicate their life. Or they would scream down the aisle in tears. I wasn't saved before, but now I am. I've had a revelation. I went, you know, yeah, I got that, you know. Because I was, you know, I wanted everything kind of perfect. And I realized, you know, at the age of 7... I realized I hadn't really been saved at the age of 5. This is a true story. So I went to my mom and said, Mama, I wasn't saved last time. I need to be saved again. She freaked out and called the pastor. And so I met with the pastor. And It really is the first Kleenex, because he said something really, really important to me, something that I still carry with me, and it was something so simple, but something that I have forgotten at times in my life, and that is, he sat there and he said, "You know, Don, when you were 5, you had the faith of a 5-year-old, but now you're 7, and you have the faith of a 7-year-old, and so it looks so much different than it used to." What a miraculous story that is for our entire life, you know. And I look into my program today, you know, that the crazy things I did, you're going to hear some of them early in the program, you know. That doesn't negate what I learned, you know, because now I have a little bit of time in the program. I entered the program of Al-Anon on or about Christmas 1981. I say on or about because I was kind of a fog. You know, we have fogs too in Al-Anon, you know. Y'all don't have the corner on those. So I went merrily on my way, and went, and I was, you'll never guess I was a weird little kid, would you? Not with the wonderful social skills I have today. I was modeled the program, of course. But anyway, oh my goodness, the warning. Uh-oh, I'm running out of Kleenex. I'm sure someone will run and get a box if I need it. But I think I'm fine. I think I'm fine. So anyway, but all I had really was this little church group. And I think they kind of tolerated me, you know. But that was all I really had. And I was kind of a scared little kid. I didn't date. That won't surprise you. And here comes the Kleenex already. Excellent. I always like to have a backup. So I didn't really have any social thing that I did except with this little church group. So it kind of made me okay. Because what I really was looking for was, I was looking for it. I wanted it. I think some of you found it in a bottle. You know, I wanted it to make me okay. And so this little group was it for me. And one year, my senior year, I think it was my senior year in high school, we went on a mountaintop experience. I'm sure you've been to those little church groups where you go up to the mountain and you get these fire and brimstone preachers screaming at you, and then you have these workshops, and then you hold hands and sing Kumbaya and all this stuff, you know. And it was wonderful. It was so it. And we came down like in the movie San Francisco, where they're walking down the mountain, you know, singing. I would come down the mountain. Some of you are old enough to remember that. We would come singing down the mountain. I started the program when I was very young, by the way. And so, but then pretty soon that kind of faded. We were all sitting in the front row, and the preacher kind of said, "Look at our little youth group here." And we all said, we're going to sit on the front row every Sunday, right behind the deacons. And pretty soon it was like 3 rows, and it was 2 rows, and it was 1 row, then it was 1/2 row. And my recollection, it was just me. I think that's just my elaboration of the past. But it just kind of faded and went, oh, heck, that wasn't it. Darn, missed out on that one. So then I went up to college. I said, well, okay, God, I'll give you one more chance. So I went to there was a student union there at my campus for our religious organization there. And I went every day at noon to noonday services. And they had these guys there, and they had it. They walked to class. They wore suits to class. They knew the dress code. And they had their Bible. Ready for this? Their Bible was tabbed. Had tabs, so if you ask them any question, they could find it in the tab and answer it. They had it. Now, I am not disparaging organized religion. I'm a member of an organized religion. But oh my God, I bought the tabs and the little guide and what you... I didn't quite get to the point of putting the tabs in my Bible, so I didn't quite go that far. But anyway, I watched these guys. And then suddenly an awareness came over me. I looked at them, and I just realized they were phony. Don't you love it when you just have these insights about other people that suddenly flash on you? Because I couldn't feel like they looked. So you know what I mean? And so I went, it's all phony. Not that I was a black and white thinker or anything. It's all phony. pushed God to the back burner of that stove and went on happily looking for it. Yes, I found it. He was tall. He was the kind of person, he was exciting. He'd walk into a room and he'd command everyone's attention. And he had it. And I felt like I could bask in his glory. And he paid attention to me. He looked at me. Oh my God, it was wonderful. We were together 13 years, seven of which we shouldn't have been together, I'm sure. But it was, you know, it was, it really was, and I'm not, I don't disparage that relationship at all. I mean, I had a good time there, and we really did love one another in the way that we could. I'm not sure how deep that love was or what it was really based on, but it became it for me. It became, my life was identified as being his boyfriend, his lover. That was my life. The dynamic of this was I didn't have a good set of rules, so I borrowed his set of rules. Okay. If you don't have any, there are people who are willing to loan you yours. Theirs. I don't know exactly what happened, but when we were just dating, he saw me with someone else. I don't know, remember if I was on a date with someone else or whatever. And he took me aside and he explained to me how things worked. He said, he dated a guy one time, and he saw him with someone else at a bar. He followed him into the bathroom and beat the heck out of him. I said, got it. I learned that rule real quickly. I didn't have to experiment with that rule. Now, he was never physically abusive, but he didn't have to be. You know, from then on, it was his rules. And from then on, whatever he said was right, and my thoughts were wrong, and it was my fault when things went wrong. And I absolutely believed it all, you know. He wasn't an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. He could way have benefited from the Al-Anon program. He actually came once, but he's a psychologist. So, I'm sorry, so there's probably psychologists here. But he was a psychologist. He came... His actually expression was, he went to Al-Anon, but they didn't want what I had, and so he didn't go back. He used those real words, those exact words. So this went on for some time. And during this time is when I became introduced to Al-Anon. It was toward the end of that relationship, actually, that I did. It was going pretty bad. I'm going pretty rotten. We always vacationed separately because I was a school teacher and I had to work all summer because I was in private schools. And so he had the summer off because he was a school teacher at public school. So he'd go and travel around and pick up various diseases and share them with me later. It's amazing how one can be in denial the third time you go to the doctor for a gamma globulin shot, you know, amazing. Thank God for penicillin, you know. But I mean, the denial that I was in was absolutely incredible, and none of my friends were in such denial. They didn't have, they couldn't. What could they have told me? Would I have believed them? No. So, anyway, it was about this time that my older brother, whom I adore. We were on the phone one time, and I said I was going to come up and see him at Thanksgiving. He said, oh, no, you won't see me at Thanksgiving. I said, why not? And I could hear his hand touch the back of his forehead when he said, I'll be in treatment. I said, for what? He said, I'm an alcoholic. And I gave the classic Al-Anon answer to that. Oh, no, you're not. So, well, he allowed us he was. He allowed us how he was. So the interesting thing was, I went up for Thanksgiving. He wasn't there, but everybody walked on eggs as if he were there. Christmas, same thing. If we say the wrong thing, Ralph might drink. We've got to be really careful or Ralph might drink. Ralph was drinking. We didn't know that, you know. So anyway, That was actually in December of 81 when my brother actually achieved sobriety. And I did, unbeknownst to me at the time, my little sister also entered AA. She didn't tell me until later. And I entered Al-Anon. So we all came in at the same time. So all of us just celebrated 30 years. I'd like to say that at family reunions we have 30 cubed of serenity, and it doesn't always happen that way. But it is an amazing thing. It says in our opening in Al-Anon that change the family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon ideas, and it really, really has. We've just been through some very trying times. Buried my father two weeks ago, and yes, it was difficult, and there were a couple of meltdowns, but the way that we held ourselves together and the way that we got through that was absolutely amazing, and we're still going through that. But how wonderful this program has been, and we all speak the same language. Then there's our little brother. We won't... Bless his heart. That's what we say in Texas. You all know what bless his heart means. I don't need to tell you. But, so I come into Al-Anon, and you know something? The amazing thing, you learn in Al-Anon, you learn that you have feelings and that you can express them. That's very dangerous. And it became literally physically dangerous to me one day when we were roofing the house. In a thunderstorm, while we were late for vacation, and I had a full-blown anxiety attack, freak-out, meltdown on the roof with an electric staple gun in my hand. No one was wounded. But literally, I had a blackout. I know that, there was nothing involved chemically. I had a blackout. I freaked out. And I remember kind of breathing, coming down to normal in the car on the way on our vacation. And somehow a tarp got thrown over that roof, and we left. I'm not sure how that happened. Years later, we sold the house later, but years later I went back, and that's a nice roof on that house. Lots of staples in that roof. The house will fall down before the roof comes off. So anyway, I wish I were making this up, but it's really the truth. So, marriage on the rocks, going crazy, alcoholism has just introduced itself, and of course it's been there long, but I didn't know it. My parents are an alcoholic. Their parents are alcoholic. So I began going to Al-Anon. One of the nicest things about Al-Anon? It's right next to a room full of them. Oh, and we love them. Trust me. And I found one of them. Now, I'd like to say, that I came to Al-Anon. I learned about myself. I separated from my partner. I had 6 months or a year to learn about me before I went into the new relationship. Uh-uh. They overlapped over a weekend. It was just tactical error. They weren't supposed to overlap. But it was his fault, my first partner's fault. So and the new one, oh my goodness, ocean of passion. No one in the world had ever known love as we knew. No, and I still have that feeling every now and then. So at any rate, I'm sure his sponsor told him no major changes in the first year. But by that time, I had a year and a half in Al-Anon. He had 6 months. Hey, that's 2 years. Do the math. As Bill Clinton says, do the math. So... I'm not doing politics today. But so we rode off into the sunset. AA Al-Anon relationship. I was almost like that kumbaya moment again. And it went so well for about 3 months. And then he had a little slip. Now, I had some Al-Anon, so I knew that, you know, you don't do the wrong thing. You know, this is the right thing and the wrong thing. So I decided the first thing I would do is ignore it. Pretend it didn't happen. He came back in the program, got sober. It didn't work. He drank again. What was that about? That was supposed to work. So I said, the next time he came back into AA, I said, well, this time I'm going to show concern. So I showed concern. It didn't work. He drank again. I never poured out his liquor. I did make a little mark as to how full it was. I really did. I'm sorry. A little Sharpie, you know. We did this swinging door thing somewhere between 3 and 5, 6 years. I don't really know. You know, I was the crazy one. I was the crazy one. He wasn't crazy. He was perfectly happy. I was the crazy one. And so as time went on and things kind of got more crazy, finally I did it a little differently this time. And this time what I really did was I took stock. I worked my program. I had worked a few steps by this time. Now, I had to do the fourth step twice because on the first four step, I left out a little bit, like the entire first relationship of 13 years. I hear I'm not unique in that. But I had done another one by this time, so I kind of a little more aware. So I really did. I gave him and the landlord 6 weeks notice, which I thought was only fair, you know. And I really did kind of move out. But, you know, now it was just me. This was the first time since I had lived with my parents that I lived with myself. I didn't have that boyfriend there to make, you know, my series of its had all failed. I was coming to Al-Anon. You could count his drinks on my face, you know. Sure you all know what I'm talking about. Sometime in this period of time, I had been separated from my first partner for probably about, it was in the midst of this before I don't know how many years, like I said, it's a fog. But it was 4 years since we had broken up. In fact, I happen to know it was 4 years to the day since we broke up. And that realization came to me later. Because we actually broke up, my first partner and I broke up. The last time I saw him was on his birthday. It was when I went down to that house with a great roof. I went down there to get all my stuff. And he had his new boyfriend there, by the way. I left mine at home. I was at least polite enough not to bring mine. Good God. His was right there. And so we had this screaming fight over this knife set. Now, thank goodness we didn't use them, but they were not expensive. I still have 4 of the set of 8. That was a long time ago. And I still have them. And they're kind of important to me now because they're kind of a symbol now. They have taken on a different meaning. But we had this screaming fight over the knife set, and I ran to the bathroom crying and, you know, drama, drama, drama. And in comes the new boyfriend, and he says, do you think Ken will be faithful to me? I'd like to say I ascended to a higher spiritual plane at that moment, but I didn't. I said, why should he? He wasn't to me. You know, so I had a little unhealthy joy out of it. I was not brand new in the program at the time. You realize I had about 5 years in Al-Anon out the window. So anyway, like I said, the dynamic of this whole relationship had been, you know, he would simply throw these things out at me and I would be wounded and I would be at fault and I would be wrong. Well, at any rate, at 4 years, and I remembered later that it was his birthday, I suddenly had to call, I felt the need to call him. Did not remember it was his birthday till I hung up the phone. I needed to call him, so I called my sponsor. I said, I want to call Ken. But I don't know, I need an excuse. You need to supply me with an excuse to call him because I want to call him. He says, just call him. I said, no, you don't understand. We haven't spoken in 4 years. I need an excuse to call him. He said, just call him. I said, but he said, call him. So I called Ken, and we had a wonderful conversation. He had gone through a series. I was still on my first one after him. He was on like his fourth one after me, but you know, who's counting? Who's keeping score? So anyway, we had this wonderful conversation, and quickly into it, I learned that he and his partner Steve had AIDS. Now, this was back before the magic drugs, the wonderful, wonderful medications we have today that have done so much to regulate that disease. It's still a deadly disease, but it's so much more than regulated than it was. Well, this was before any of that happened, so it basically was a death sentence. And so we had this talk, and I'm freaking out, you know. And when I hung up the phone, I called my sponsor. He said, I told him the whole story. He says, okay, you have a wonderful opportunity now to make amends to him. I said, what? Me? Make amends to him? You weren't listening when I did that fifth step, were you? He owes me, of course, he wouldn't allow that. The wonderful thing about amends, and it's true for me today, and that is, it's not a matter of who's at fault. It's not a matter of who did what. Amends means healing. And that's what it was. It was healing. I'm not sure this is true, but as I look at the origins of the word amend, there's a word called mendacity, which means untruth, and A means the opposite of. So I look as amend as doing away with the falsehood and only bringing out the truth. Amends. And that's what I got the glorious opportunity to do. And what he said was, what you're going to do is you're going to call him on a regular basis. You are never to... I had the rules of amends right there. Every single phone call, I had the amends rules, and I hope you all know what they are. You never bring up the other person's faults. He says, and you're not even really there to make a big, I'm sorry. Oh, I can't stand, I'm sorry. Some of you, I'm sorry, I just said it. I hate I'm sorry, and I'm sorry that I hate I'm sorry. But that's not what amends, to me, amends aren't about I'm sorry. They're about I'm changing, and they're about we're changing. And so he said, you're to listen and you're to be there in his life. And that is all. And so I called and he would bitch and he'd complain. I'm sorry, I tried not to use... That was a five-letter word, wasn't it? Wasn't four. Okay, I can count that. Anyway, he'd complain and complain. And I would listen. And, you know, it had a tremendous healing effect on me. I don't know what it did for him, but I was there to offer healing to him. And one of the important things for me about amends is that you keep the door open. And that when this amends is over, my door is open. If I'm there to shut you up and throw up on your shoes and walk off, that's not amends to me. Amends is to heal and to keep the door open. So anyway, I listen. And... We were together, we used to always go to the opera together, and we both love opera, and neither one of our partners liked opera. So we went to the opera a few times. And the whole friendship re-emerged. One time we accidentally met at a home in some friends in Houston, and they were playing opera, and they were playing some Rossini. Well, in Rossini, all the men sing way up there. I can't sing that. They sing in falsetto, what we would call falsetto. They used to call them castrati. They don't do that anymore, though. I don't think. Anyway. And so we're sitting there, and he and I got the giggles. And everyone was telling us to shut up. And we got the giggles. But it was like that whole... It felt so healing to sit and laugh with this person and to really feel, you know, at ease and everything. And the resentment just began to fall away. It began to fall off. A few years later... Maybe a couple of years later, I don't know exactly. We had an appointment to go to the opera, and he was ill. And so he had been ill a lot, you know. I lived in Dallas. He lived in actually a suburb of Fort Worth. And so I got someone else to go to the opera with me. We went to the opera. And then I had never done this before, but for some reason I decided to go visit my hospital. So I drove after the opera over to the hospital in Fort Worth, and his nieces were there. They are still my nieces. I'm still Uncle Don to them. Many, many years later, I'm still, and some of them are in the program. I 12-stepped a few of them into Al-Anon also, but that's another story. That'll take another hour. So I went over there, and we were talking and everything, and then they left, and we're still talking. We're talking about the opera and everything, and then went on and on. And then all of a sudden, he looked straight at me in the eye, and he said, "You know, Don, if you hadn't left, none of this would have happened." And you know the real miracle of that? That totally missed. It didn't hurt at all. I felt no pain from that at all. I didn't need to come back and correct him. "Excuse me, I believe this has to do with your behavior." I didn't do any of that stuff. I picked up his little hand, and I patted his little hand. And then it went away. And then it was gone. The resentment was gone. The amends was finished. I mean, do you ever get the experience of finishing an amends? I walked out of the hospital, hardly touching the ground. It felt so wonderful. He went into a coma the next day and died 3 days later. Who knew? Well, someone knew. Someone kicked my ass to get over there in Fort Worth and have that experience. And if I hadn't been in the program of Al-Anon, I would never have experienced that. And that is the kind of healing I feel I find every day in this program. Resentments are just not worth the trouble, you know. And yeah, we're going to get them. We are creatures of resentment. Of course we're going to experience those. Lots of more ninth step stories, but that to me is one of my biggest ones. Today in the program, I have a home group, Lambda, in Dallas, and I sponsor people. I am sponsored. And what I espouse and what I have learned, we read it in that opening, the Al-Anon opening. It says, "Changed attitudes can aid recovery." I hated that when I came in. Every time I went to school and I got in trouble, they said, "You have a bad attitude." I said, "What the heck is that?" Well, attitude, it's because this is a disease of perception. This is a disease of, you know, what we see and what the next person sees are two different things. My mother had a real big problem when I first came out to her. My father, on the other hand, I was his favorite little gay boy. I was never had a problem with my father. My mother had a little problem with it. And at one point, she looked at me and she said, I said, "Well, don't you even love me?" She says, "Of course I love you. I have to love you." But I saw that as nasty and mean. But listen to it this way. "Of course I love you. I have to love you." And that's what she meant. She didn't mean she was following some book of rules, that she had some tab in a Bible that told her what she had to do. She meant she could not help but love me. And that is the healing that occurred in our family due to the programs of AA and Al-Anon. You know, they read the, I couldn't get a printed copy of these, so I'm going to be reading them online. You'll excuse me. I called one of my friends in my home group and said, "You know, they've been reading the AA promises, and they totally forgot to read the Al-Anon promises." "Huh? How many of you even know about the Al-Anon promises?" "Ah, a few Al-Anon members, of course." I said, "Well, they're a little longer, so I purposely..." So I've been watching the clock to make sure I have time to do this. But I would like to close my sharing with you today with this. And it's from the book called From Survival to Recovery. And it's an incredible, we have some incredible Al-Anon literature. And that is one of the greatest books. And it's geared toward those who grew up in alcoholic homes. But you know, we're not all that different. You know, but some alcoholics also grew up in alcoholic homes. I definitely recommend this piece of literature. But it says, if we willingly surrender ourselves to the spiritual discipline of the 12 steps, our lives will be transformed.
It's coming. I just have to have it.
We will become mature, responsible individuals with a great capacity for joy, fulfillment, and wonder. Though we may never be perfect, continued spiritual progress will reveal to us our enormous potential. We will discover that we are both worthy of love and loving. We will love others without losing ourselves, and will learn to accept love in return. Our sight, once clouded and confused, will clear, and we will be able to perceive reality and recognize truth. Courage and fellowship will replace fear. We will be able to risk failure to develop new hidden talents. Our lives, no matter how battered and degraded, will yield hope to share with others. We will begin to feel and will come to know the vastness of our emotions, but we will not be slaves to them. Our secrets will no longer bind us in shame. As we gain the ability to forgive others, our families, our world, and ourselves, our choices will expand. With dignity, we will stand for ourselves, but not against our fellows. Serenity and peace will have meaning for us as we allow our lives and the lives of those we love to flow day by day with God's ease, balance, and grace. No longer terrified, we will discover we are free to delight in life's paradox, mystery, and awe. We will laugh more. Fear will be replaced by faith, and gratitude will come naturally as we realize that our higher power is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Can we really grow to such proportions? Only if we accept life as a continuing process of maturation and evolution toward wholeness. Then we suddenly begin to notice these gifts appearing. We see them in those who walk beside us, sometimes slowly or haltingly, occasionally in great bursts of brilliance. Those who work the steps change and grow toward light, toward health, and toward their higher power. Watching others, we realize this is also possible for us. Our fifth tradition says our primary purpose. Our purpose is to help families of alcoholics. We do, and by the way, do you know anyone who doesn't fit that category? We do this by practicing the 12 steps ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to the families of alcoholics. Thank you for working that tradition for me today. Thank you for asking me to speak.